Money Radio. Thank you for joining us today. At a time when some companies are so large that they dwarf the GDP of nations and supply chains are literally interwoven throughout the world, corporate responsibility has never been more important. Until now, though, no one has really explored the psyche that motivates corporate leaders to protect people and the planet, and this might be something that is really quite important. It is the subject of a new book, A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership, The Hidden Power of Ecological Worldviews, by our guest today, Dr. Stephen Shine. Dr. Shine has over 30 years of leadership experience as a CEO and co-founder of an NYSE company, a senior executive with Nabisco and Ernst & Young. He is a faculty member at Southern Oregon University, and he has been a pioneer in sustainability leadership, teaching, and research. The new book, A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership. Dr. Shine, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Sinclair. Thank you.
What do we mean when we say sustainability? Because I think a lot of people have some very differing ideas on what that might mean.
Sure. Well, we can trace it back to the early 70s and the beginning of the modern environmental movement in the United States with the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the establishment of the EPA. That really began a multi-decade evolution that initially was corporate philanthropy and then moved into corporate social responsibility as corporations both responded to the regulatory environment as well as their reputations and attitudes and their customers for the products they were selling. And around early 90s, we had the first sustainable development conference. In fact, we're now on the 21st. It's going to happen in Paris in a couple of weeks. So for about almost 25 years now, the word sustainability has been in the dialogue, and it's come to mean so much that in some ways, you know, it means everything and it means nothing. I use it in my book, and what I focus on is as relates to corporations and the environmental and social impacts of their products and their manufacturing processes. And it's come to include a wide range of both environmental and social issues and intersects with everything from healthcare to food policy to renewable energy, how we build our buildings. And then it also has to do with employees around the world in these big, as you mentioned, global supply chains, fair labor, working conditions. And so it's a very broad field that is commonly known now in the corporate world as sustainability or corporate social and environmental responsibility.
I think for many people, we hear the term sustainability with corporate sustainability, and we think, well, that's a marketing fad. It's nothing more. We know that corporations
right.
really don't look much beyond the quarterly statements. Is that jaded?
Right.
Is that skepticism, or is it founded?
Right, and that actually is what drove 5 years ago the beginning of my research and what led to this book. Teaching in a university, students would also share that same skepticism. And what I wanted to do, and I couldn't find it anywhere, is really look under the covers and really get a sense on the deeper motivations of the individuals behind these initiatives at multinational corporations. And what I began to do was attend conferences around the country, meet a lot of these executives, have a chance to visit with them both face-to-face and over the phone, and really ask questions about who they are, where their motivations come from, what their challenges are. And that's what the book is about. And I guess I could say that I think it's surprising that the majority of corporations these days, especially in, say, consumer products. What I'm talking about is kind of all the companies and all the brands that we're familiar with as opposed to other segments of the economy, that there's a deepening understanding that there's a lot of ways that corporations need to change the way they do business, the way they manufacture their products, so as to address a lot of these environmental and social problems in all the communities around the world where they operate. So this common idea of it's greenwashing, it's just about the bottom line, you know, I think to a large extent in all of the people that I know directly and all the companies that I interface with is at a minimum a very small part of the story. It's true in certain instances, but I think it's a much deeper and more surprisingly complex story about really what's happening these days as relates to corporate social responsibility and sustainability.
And it is a complicated issue because not only do corporations need to understand sustainability, but the population of the world relies on large part on corporations to clothe and feed and house and provide all the other accoutrements of what we consider day-to-day living. We can't just do it all on our own. For most people, the idea of going and living off the grid somewhere and spinning our own cotton and growing our own food just isn't that realistic. So we rely upon corporations, corporations rely upon us, and we all rely upon the earth that we're on. So then the question is, just how deep is that commitment to sustainability, and how have you been able to measure those levels of commitment?
Great question, Sinclair. And for instance, I just came from the Global Engagement Forum in Washington, D.C., which is leaders from government, from nonprofits, and from the private sector, all engaged in collaborative projects related to address social and environmental issues around the world. And the prospect of that's where the problems have to be addressed. They really can't be solved in a vacuum. Corporations have to be at the table with government agencies and with the world's largest nonprofits, both on the environmental and the social side, in order to, from a systems perspective, really make progress on these what we call wicked problems in the sustainability movement. And in terms of measurement, there is a tremendous body of research that's getting more and more valid around natural capital. For instance, on the environmental side, we're now using life cycle analysis. We really know the environmental footprint of any product, and that way we can redesign how we manufacture it, what also is commonly known as cradle to cradle, from the inception of a product and all the raw materials and resource extraction all the way to commonly would be thought of as recycling, but it's a deeper when we talk about an entire supply chain. And so the metrics that are being used started with the GRI, the Global Reporting Initiative, but now there's companies like Trucost that are actually reporting in the financial and footnotes of all public companies progress against a wide range of very specific metrics. And I encourage and invite anybody interested to explore some of these reports that are available for almost any company. Any public company has some kind of sustainability report now. And what's exciting is it's actually now being embedded into the regular quarterly reporting as part of the core strategy of the company. And so there's a lot of very specific metrics that are available now that I've used in my classes for many years.
It's a real interesting idea because in the field of economics for a long time, we've talked about externalities. We have to start thinking, I suppose, about the ecology as an externality, the environment as an externality. And it's not just the price of something or even taxes or subsidies that go into it, but really what is this added cost on the environment? And I'm not sure that we're at this point where we've really included that in for most corporations at this point, but being able to measure it through that true cost, cradle-to-cradle kind of analysis, I think is very important. You mentioned something, though, that I think a lot of people probably aren't aware of, that there are sustainability executives in many major large corporations now.
Yes, I'm happy to call many of them close friends and colleagues. And I, for instance, have just returned from both Seattle and Washington, D.C. in the last 5 days to two annual conferences. I sit on the board of an organization called Net Impact, and we convened 2,500 MBA students from around the 300 chapters around the country, with about 300 senior executives from companies that are part of the sustainability departments, and hold a wide range of panels and breakout sessions. And these executives are the group that I study in my book, and I interview and include lots of quotes from, because I think they are very impactful in terms of driving change from within the corporate system to this movement towards environmental and social responsibility. And so I also invite folks that are listening to explore that these positions often are very close to the C-suite. There's a chief sustainability officer in most companies now that report into the CEO and the senior executive group. And more those individuals are the experts at helping the company integrate environmental and social initiatives into the strategy of the company, not just something on the side, not just something nice, not just something, you know, that is superficial, but something that actually has to change the core strategy of a company.
Why do they do it? What drives them?
Thank you. And what I think I've tried to address in my research is to try to start to answer that question. My findings indicate that many of these executives are motivated by what I call their ecological worldview, which is their capacity to see our relationship with ecosystems and our interdependence, how we affect the Earth's ecosystems in regional food sheds and watersheds, and the big macro issues around the stability of climate and how that relates to our oceans and forests. And so that capacity often motivates on a very deep level the actions, because this is hard. This is not the dominant, as we all know. Wall Street operates still on a short-term earnings perspective. And to have kind of the stamina and the resiliency to continue to try to change the system and integrate ecological economics requires that kind of motivation. And so that's what I find from my research. That's what I'm happy to share with you and your listeners, Sinclair. And I think it's a very important capacity for the leaders now in the 21st century to have, because we are really facing this much more complicated external environment.
And how do they go about achieving sustainability leadership in that Wall Street environment that you've just described?
I'm happy to say that, you know, for instance, in Washington, the last 2 days at the Global Engagement Forum are individuals that come from Wall Street, come from some of the most well-known banks and hedge funds, as well as many of the largest corporations in the world, and so I think the for instance, there's a organization, one of the oldest ones on kind of corporate environmental and social responsibility, called Ceres in Boston, that came out of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and Ceres convenes a conference and a group called BICEP, Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy. And this is a global network of corporations and nonprofits that are making progress about this this worldview of sustainability leadership from within the financial sector in particular, because I think it is a key linchpin, if you will, is the more that there's financial incentives for corporations to integrate sustainability leadership, the higher probability that we can accelerate this change.
Key point there. We're talking with Dr. Steve Shine. He is the author of a new book, A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership. A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership. We will continue the conversation in just a moment. Money Radio, thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Dr. Steve Shine, and that's spelled S-C-H-I-N-E. S-E-I-N. The new book, A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership, The Hidden Power of Ecological Worldviews. And in the book, you talk about the ecological self and break it down into deep ecology, eco-psychology, and integral ecology. Can you explain that briefly for us?
Sure. And I'm happy to say that Pope Francis in his environmental encyclical has actually gone a long way to talking about integral ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I mean by that is we wake up every day and we kind of have our psychological identity, not something we necessarily are conscious of, but we identify ourselves as part of a community. And the ecological self is one opportunity that we have to identify ourselves and feel that we are embedded in the natural world. And it's hard if we live in a city and we're with our technology and our mobile phones, we're so disconnected from that feeling, but that ecological self is available to all of us, and it is a part of our reality. And the extent that we at least consider that and perhaps take time to explore that further, that can often open up a new way of perceiving our relationship to these ecosystems that we do depend on for life. And so this idea of an ecological self that can then drive kind of a deeper commitment, or at least a questioning a little bit of some of the unsustainable practices of our lifestyle or our leadership, is something that I offer as a contribution to kind of the overall sustainability field in my book, and really welcome the ongoing dialogue about it.
One of the few books, or one of the few things that I've seen that dealt with that idea of integral ecology that the Pope brought up, it was kind of a new term for me when we saw that in the Pope's encyclical. So a call for corporations around the world to incorporate this integral ecology into their planning. Are you seeing that response take place, but are you also seeing it in education?
Well, I'll just share with you very quickly. I just came from Italy, where I had a chance to meet with two of the Jesuit scholars that translated the actual encyclical from Pope Francis into English and put the title Chapter 4 of Integral Ecology. And they said something astonishing to me in our meeting a couple of weeks ago, that within a couple of weeks of the encyclical being published, that it erased 500 years of the Leonardo effect, or the reference to Leonardo da Vinci and the separation between science and theology, or science and spirituality. And I'm still reverberating kind of the power of that reflection by these amazing thought leaders there in Italy in the Jesuit order. And so I think in terms of education, there's a lot of structural impediments, I think, in higher education. And unfortunately, the tenure and promotion rewards kind of this peer-reviewed publishing and journals that often really are not accessible to the wider population, and especially the private sector and corporations. And so I really encourage everybody in the Academy of Management and in business schools especially to kind of break out of that somewhat siloed, more insular dynamic. And I should mention, I'm having this conversation today from the Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, where I'm now an expert in residence. Presidio is one of the first green MBA programs. There's great programs happening up in Bainbridge, Washington, in Burlington, Vermont, with a new SEMBA program. But they're not the mainstream. And business schools everywhere really need to address these environmental, social challenges. We have amazing capacity and thought leaders and research. But higher education needs to break out of this system rewarding faculty for tenure and promotion just by doing these peer-reviewed journal publications. And it has to be more about solving actual problems on the ground for everybody.
Dr. Shine, until we can figure out some other place to do business, this planet is it. So we better figure out how to keep the workplace in good order. A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership, The Hidden Power of Ecological Worldviews. I think it's an important book, and it's a very readable book. A New Psychology for Sustainability Leadership by Stephen Shine, joining us today, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sinclair. Enjoyed the conversation very much.